tragic and terrible 12 days of retreat that prevented the French armies from disintegrating into a shattered and fragmentary mass. A more brilliant, more quick-thinking commander with ideas of his own might have avoided basic initial errors. But after the debacle, the one thing France needed, Joffre had. It is difficult to imagine any other man who could have brought the French armies out of retreat in condition and position to fight again. When the moment to turn came, alone he would have been insufficient. The stand he contemplated at the Seine might well have come too late. It was Gallieni who saw the opportunity, and with a powerful assist from Franchet d'Esperey, provoked the earlier counteroffensive. It was the broken figure of Lanrezac, allowed no share at the Marne, who in saving France from the original folly of Plan 17, made recovery possible. Ironically, both his decision at Charleroi and his replacement by Franchet d'Esperey were equally necessary to the counteroffensive. But it was Joffre, whom nothing could panic, who provided the army to fight it. "If we had not had him in 1914," said Foch, his ultimate successor, "I don't know what would have become of us." The world remembers the battle ever since by the taxis. 100 of them were already in the service of the military government of Paris. With 500 more, each carrying 5 soldiers and making the 60-kilometer trip to the Ourcq twice, General Clergerie figured he could transport 6,000 troops to the hard-pressed front. The order was issued at 1 p.m., the hour for departure fixed for 6 p.m. Police passed the word to the taxis in the streets. Enthusiastically, the chauffeurs emptied out their passengers, explaining proudly that they had to go to the battle. Returning to their garages for gas, they were ordered to the place of assembly, where at the given time all 600 were lined up in perfect order. Gallieni, called to inspect them, though rarely demonstrative, was enchanted. "Eh bien, voilà au moins qui n'est pas banal. Well, here at least is something out of the ordinary," he cried. Each with its burden of soldiers, with trucks, buses and assorted vehicles added to the train, the taxis drove off as evening fell. The last gallantry of 1914, the last crusade of the old world. After the incomplete victory of the Marne, they followed the German retreat to the Aisne, the race to the sea for possession of the Channel ports, the fall of Antwerp, and the Battle of Ypres, where officers and men of the BEF held their ground, fought literally until they died, and stopped the Germans in Flanders. Not Mons or the Marne, but Ypres was the real monument to British valour, as well as the grave of 4/5 of the original BEF. After it, with the advent of winter, came the slow, deadly sinking into the stalemate of trench warfare. Running from Switzerland to the Channel like a gangrenous wound across French and Belgian territory, the trenches determined the war of position and attrition, the brutal, mud-filled, murderous insanity known as the Western Front that was to last for 4 more years. The Schlieffen Plan had failed, but it had succeeded far enough to leave the Germans in occupation of all of Belgium and all of northern France down to the Aisne. As Clemenceau's paper was tirelessly to remind its readers, month after month, year after year, "Messieurs, les Allemands sont toujours à Noyon." Gentlemen, the Germans are still in Noyon. For their presence there, deep within France, the error of Plan 17 was responsible. It had allowed the enemy to penetrate too far to be dislodged by the time the French regathered their strength at the Marne. It permitted the breakthrough that could only be stemmed, and later only contained, at a cost of the terrible drain of French manhood that was to make the war of 1914-1918 the parent of 1940. It was an error that could never be repaired. In the chapel of Saint-Cyr, the French military academy, before it was destroyed during World War II, the memorial tablet to the dead of the Great War bore only a single entry for the class of 1914. The mortality rate is further illustrated by the experience of André Varagnac, a nephew of the cabinet minister Marcel Samba, who came of military age in 1914 but was not mobilized in August owing to illness, and found himself, out of 27 boys in his lycée class, the only one alive by Christmas. According to Armée Française, French casualties in the month of August alone amounted to 206,515, including killed, wounded, and missing, out of total effectives for the armies in the field of 1,600,000. As these figures do not include officers or garrison and territorial divisions, the number is believed to be nearer 300,000. Most were incurred during the 4 days of the Battle of the Frontiers. No separate figures have been published for the Battle of the Marne, but if the estimated losses through September 11 are added to those of August, the total through the first 30 days is equivalent to a daily loss of the whole population of a town the size of Soissons or Compiègne. No exact figures can be given because, in line with GQG's fixed policy against releasing any information of possible value to the enemy, casualty lists were not published. Nor is it possible to give comparable figures for the other belligerents, because they tabulated losses at different intervals and on different bases. When the war was over, the known dead per capita of population were 1 to 28 for France, 1 to 32 for Germany, 1 to 57 for England, and 1 to 107 for Russia. Failure of Plan 17 was as fatal as failure of the Schlieffen Plan, and together they produced deadlock on the Western Front. Sucking up lives at a rate of 5,000 and sometimes 50,000 a day, absorbing munitions, energy, money, brains, and trained men, the Western Front ate up Allied war resources and predetermined the failure of backdoor efforts like that of the Dardanelles, which might otherwise have shortened the war. The deadlock, fixed by the failures of the first month, determined the future course of the war and, as a result, the terms of the peace, the shape of the interwar period, and the conditions of the second round. Men could not sustain a war of such magnitude and pain without hope, the hope that its very enormity would ensure that it could never happen again, and the hope that when somehow it had been fought through to a resolution, the foundations of a better-ordered world would have been laid. Like the shimmering vision of Paris that kept Kluck's soldiers on their feet, the mirage of a better world glimmered beyond the shell-pitted wastes and leafless stumps that had once been green fields and waving poplars. Nothing less could give dignity or sense to monstrous offensives in which thousands and hundreds of thousands were killed to gain 10 yards and exchange one wet-bottomed trench for another. When every autumn people said it could not last through the winter, and when every spring there was still no end in sight, only the hope that out of it all some good would accrue to mankind kept men and nations fighting. When at last it was over, the war had many diverse results, and one dominant one transcending all others, disillusion. All the great words were cancelled out for that generation, wrote D.H. Lawrence in simple summary for his contemporaries. If any of them remembered with a twinge of pain, like Emil Verhaeren, the man I used to be, it was because he knew the great words and beliefs of the time before 1914 could never be restored. After the Marne, the war grew and spread until it drew in the nations of both hemispheres and entangled them in a pattern of world conflict no peace treaty could dissolve. The Battle of the Marne was one of the decisive battles of the world, not because it determined that Germany would ultimately lose or the Allies ultimately win the war, but because it determined that the war would go on. There was no looking back, Joffre told the soldiers on the eve. Afterward, there was no turning back. The nations were caught in a trap made during the first 30 days out of battles that failed to be decisive, a trap from which there was and has been no exit. This concludes the reading of The Guns of August by Barbara W. Tuchman. Copyright 1962 by Barbara W. Tuchman. Copyright renewed in 1990 by Dr. Lester Tuchman. Preface copyright 1988 by Barbara W. Tuchman. This book was read by Nadia May. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Russell and Volkening Incorporated and was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Incorporated. If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.